As our speaker this evening, we have Dr. Austin Potts, who is Professor of Doctrine at Philadelphia College of the Bible. Dr. Potts has his PhD from Robson University, downtown Philadelphia, in the area of comparative religion and Assyriology and Hebrew language. And he's going to speak to us this evening on the subject Sinai Revisited. Dr. Potts, we're glad to have you with us. Come up here and let me put the microphone on.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to read from Exodus chapter 19 and verses 1 to 8. Exodus 19 and verses 1 to 8. In the third month, when the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai. For they were departed from Rephidim, but come to the desert of Sinai, and had encamped in the wilderness. And there Israel camped before the mount. And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called unto him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests, and an holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. And Moses came and called for the elders of the people, and laid before their faces all these words which the Lord commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, All that the Lord hath spoken we will do. And Moses returned the words of the people unto the Lord. May the Lord add his blessing to the reading of this portion of his word. I feel very honored to be included in this series here at Biblical Seminary. And by way of background, I should say that I had the opportunity of taking an eight-day camping trip into Sinai in the spring of 1974. That same summer, I became involved in archaeological work in Israel, working at the Jerusalem Wall, at the wall of the Old City of Jerusalem, and also at the site of Aphek. A very excellent archaeological site in that it has evidence of occupation for the main periods of biblical archaeology. In reference to Sinai, I'd like to say this, that talk about, first of all, the history of Sinai, background of Sinai. Then I want to talk a little bit about the climate and the rainfall, and then briefly about the plants and animals that you find there. A few words about the natural resources, and then I want to talk about some of the buildings, the Nawamis, the Serbit al-Kadim, an ancient Egyptian temple, and St. Catherine's. Now, that's a pretty big order. But I want to talk about some of these things until we get down to talking about some of the buildings, and then I want to move back in the room to the projector, and some of the things you'll show at first on the screen then will be a review of some of the things I already have talked about. And we will also go on further, I hope, if time permits, into talking about some of the buildings of Sinai. You might say that Sinai did not exist as a geopolitical unit before the 20th century. It was not until after World War I that there was a notable failure to define the situation or the status of the section that we might call Sinai. We might add also that during most of its recent history, there was no problem of borders or sovereignty. Whoever controlled the roads of Sinai down through the years was the accepted ruler of that portion. It was not until the 19th century, with the awakening of nationalism, that Sinai became a political issue, greatly influenced by meddling European powers. It's also difficult to locate precisely the mountain that we might call the Sinai of Moses, the lawgiver. Christian tradition that goes back to around the 4th or 5th century AD sticks to the present day site called Jebel Musa, or the mountain of Moses, as the Sinai of the Old Testament. Sinai is important to us as Bible students, because the Bible and tradition associate Moses and Elijah and even Jesus' transfiguration with Mount Sinai. A few words about the climate of Sinai. We realize that Sinai is that triangular-shaped piece of territory serving as a land bridge between Africa and Asia, and also, in a sense, a land bridge between Asia and Europe. And Sinai receives very little rainfall. In fact, some suggested that the rainfall and the weather conditions in Sinai probably have not changed much over the last 5,000 years. The rainfall that does come to Sinai is irregular. Rains may come anytime between November and May, but usually the rains and the snows come at the extremities of this period. In other words, the heaviest rains may come around November, and then in the middle of winter may be relatively dry, and then again around May, again, rains may come. Some years may pass with scarcely a drop of rainfall in Sinai, and there are other years where you may have 2 or 3 days of continuous rainfall in that area. Another very fascinating feature about Sinai is that Sinai, like the Sahara Desert, has a large fossil reservoir beneath its surface, hundreds of feet below the surface. And this has been drilled into, has been examined by geologists and others, and they estimate that there are thousands of gallons of water in this reservoir. You probably have heard it said that beneath the deserts of the Sahara, there's also this fossil water. And the testing of these waters suggests that the same water that's found beneath the Sahara, same type of water, same kind of content, is found beneath the surface of Sinai. I want to talk about the plants of Sinai. There are about 1,000 different species of plants that are found in Sinai, and some of them are especially endemic to Sinai and are completely new to science. So as scientists who get into Sinai and observe some of these new plants, they are contributing to their own knowledge and, of course, to the knowledge of everyone as they further study these forms, these plants. You'll find that the plants that grow in Sinai, like plants that grow in other desert areas, are deep-rooted plants. And there are some plants that grow in Sinai that have remarkable features of allowing some portions of their plants, of the plant, to die during an extremely dry season. And so there's some that have joints, and when the season gets very dry, they'll break off at those joints, and the extremities will fall off, and that way the plant will survive the extreme dry season. When rainfall comes, then the plant will grow once more. And so there are these joints that may drop off, or there are leaves that might drop off, or even branches that may drop off of some of these plants. It's also so there's a partial death of the plant, but without the complete death of many of the plants that that exist in Sinai. Another interesting feature about the plants of Sinai is that travel through the desert, you observe a definite spatial relationship among the plants. And there's a tendency for plants to become too crowded, then of necessity, some of them will have to die off. And so in some parts of Sinai, without man's intervention, you'll see a plant maybe in an area about the size of this room, maybe standing right in the middle of that room, and then another area, maybe 20, 30 feet away, another plant. And so you can observe a definite spatial relationship of the plants in many parts of the desert. And of course, this is true in Sinai. There are many different plants. I'll show you some pictures of some flowering plants. Unfortunately, I do not know the names of all of them that I will show later on. But it's interesting to find plants surviving under those very harsh conditions that you have in desert country. Some of the trees that you find in Sinai, first of all, are the acacia tree. Of course, we find mention of the acacia tree in reference to the building of the tabernacle, supplying the wood for that piece, building. Concerning the acacia tree, we might observe that it's a tree which has very small leaves, so that very little moisture is lost to the dry desert air. It also has very long thorns, which are strong enough to puncture your tires if you drive over a small branch. And, of course, it's specially known for its deep tap roots. I read recently in regards to this that some acacia trees may have tap roots that extend 30 meters below the surface, so that the acacia tree may survive maybe for 10 years without experiencing or feeling any rainfall, and still survive during the occasional rains that it gets. It also should be said concerning the acacia tree that it will not grow at in the high elevations of Sinai. It's a tree that likes the warmer climates. And some suggested that when you get above, say, 800 meters above sea level, that you will find very few acacia trees. Also in Sinai, in some of the wadis, you will find the date palm. And of course, the date palm is a very valuable tree in the Middle East, in that the date palm will survive in rather brackish, salty soil, while other trees and other plants are very sensitive to such soil. And of course, this is especially important in areas where irrigation may have been used repeatedly down through the years. The soil eventually becomes salty because of the evaporation of waters containing minerals. In addition to the date palm is a very valuable tree in that a good date palm may produce 300 or 400 pounds of dates in a good season. And of course, the fruit of the date palm is used by the Bedouin. And of course, the kernels and seeds are used for fodder and feed for the camels and the goats. And of course, the wood can be used for construction, for fuel, and the branches serve for roofing and for fiber for baskets and so on. So the date palm is a very valuable tree. Also, closely related to the date palm, you have the Sudanese palm tree. And this might be distinguished at first glance from the date palm in that at the very base you see a number of stalks or trunks coming out from the base of it. This is very different from the date palm, which usually has just one main trunk coming from the ground up. Also in desert country, you have the trees called the tamarisk trees, a tree which seems to be related to the cedars and an evergreen. This too will grow in rather salty water. And scientists who have studied this tree have noted that it has special glands or mechanisms within the tree that helps to excrete the surplus salt that comes into the tree. A few words about animal life. First of all, some of the domesticated animals and also the wild animals. We find that as you travel in desert country, of course, you travel mostly in the daytime and you don't see much in animal life. In the early morning, you may see some birds, and the same in the evening. And you may see some lizards in the early morning and then the evening. But midday in the desert country, all animal life takes a siesta, I guess, because it's so extremely hot. And so we find that most of the animals of Sinai are nocturnal. And of course, this is true of desert country generally, and especially true of Sinai. We find that animals are specially equipped for desert life. And animals, say, like the camel or the donkey or other long-legged animals, are specially adapted in that they are a few feet above the hot sands of the desert. And this gives them some protection from the hot desert sand. I've heard it said that the camel will not lie down in the hot sand, but rather will stay on his feet as much as he can, rather than to bed down in the hot sand and experience that inconvenience. So the long leg of the animal can help protect from the hot desert sands. Also, there are some animals that make burrows in the desert, burrows beneath the sands of the desert. And so animals, creatures like the lizard, will burrow down about 6 feet beneath the surface, where they will find coolness and protection from extreme heat. Be aware of the fact that a reptile or snakes, if they are wandering about and do not find shelter, that they'll be overcome by the heat and will perish in the hot sun after a few hours. And so it's very important for them to seek the shade of a bush or seek the shade of an outcropping cliff or rock, or to get into a burrow, or they will perish. And of course, I might add here, as far as man in the desert is concerned, it's also very important for him to have an abundant supply of water. We were traveling in Sinai. We had tanks of water with us, but this water was the air temperature that was around us. And we Americans are very spoiled in that we like ice-cold drinks of all kinds. So it's very difficult for us to swallow down the water. And yet our guide would say to us frequently, take a drink of water. And she'd urge us to drink close to a quart of water per hour. In fact, the Israeli medical doctors, in their research and study of some of the military who were active in Sinai, discovered that active people need about a quart of water per hour in the desert country. And of course, knowing that helps us to appreciate the need for water in the days when Moses was leading the people of God through Sinai. Getting back now to the animals that and how they survive in the desert, we mentioned that some have long legs, some burrow down into the ground, and of course, many animals rove about at night. And of course, the nights are generally cooler. Concerning some of the domesticated animals, a few words about the camel, the donkey, the dogs. The camel, of course, you know, is an animal that's specially adapted to desert life. But maybe you didn't know that the camel is very valuable to the Bedouin. In fact, the true Bedouin, supposedly, has camels. This is the definition that some books give us about the Bedouin, that the true Bedouin depend upon camels for existence in the desert. And the camel is a desert animal, can live to 25 to 30 years of age. They calve every third year when they're healthy, and they provide milk and hair and hides for their owners. What I want to say about the camel, I find very unusual, is that the body temperature of the camel can vary some 12, 15 degrees Fahrenheit or 6 degrees centigrade without getting sick. Now, our temperature varies maybe 2 degrees and we feel miserable, but the camel can vary its temperature, say from morning when it's cool to midday when the sun is hot. The temperature of the body of the camel may vary quite a bit without the animal showing any ill effects. It is also said of the camel that it can lose about 27% of its body water. And of course, you're familiar with the fact that the camel can take a big drink of water and then go for a few days in desert country and survive the ordeal. Again, the camel has a special kidney mechanism which helps to concentrate its urine so that not much water is lost in its body waste. And the feces, too, is relatively dry. The hair of the camel is a good insulator, and this, too, protects the camel from the extreme heat of the sun in the day and also extreme cold that you sometimes can encounter at night in desert country. The donkey, too, is pretty well adapted to desert life and to Sinai conditions. The donkey, too, can lose up to 30% of its body water. It cannot go as long a time as the camel without water, but the donkey, when it gets to water, can rehydrate very quickly and be well again. Again, the donkey is especially a good animal to have in the desert and semi-desert conditions, in that its food requirements are very modest. It can seem to be content on the ugliest briars and thistles that you can imagine. We think of the goats. Of course, in Sinai, you see oftentimes the black goats. You see also some sheep, but the black goats are a very common sight in Sinai. And it's amazing to see Bedouin families, what you can see most of all as far as their livelihood and their food supply is primarily those 20 or 30 black goats that they have. Just amazing that people can survive such harsh conditions as you find in the desert and as you find places like Sinai. Speaking about the sheep, The Bedouin raise oftentimes the fat tail sheep. And of course, that's an interesting phenomenon in that the fat is stored in the tail rather than stored over the skin of the body, or over the surface of the body. And so this, too, is a good protection for the animal. If the fat were under the skin, as it is for many animals, and for us, too, then I think the sheep would suffer severely. The wool of the animal, of course, keeps it warm in the cold weather that you may have at night, and also I think the fleece also protects it from the hot sun as well. So the wool of the fleece of the sheep protects it from the extremes of hot and cold. In Sinai, there are two types of dogs. There's the Kenite dog and the dog called the Saluki, S-A-L-U-K-I. The Saluki is a dog very much like the Afghan hound, and sometimes some of them look like the greyhound. And after seeing some of these dogs in Sinai, I looked at some of the pictures that you have on some of the Egyptian writings and the tombs and so on, and I find that those dogs do not look too different from the present-day greyhound. And some have suggested that the greyhound probably traces its origin to Egypt or some parts of the Middle East. There are some carnivorous animals in Sinai, but they are relatively few and seldom seen, such as the leopard and the fox and the wolf and other such animals. There are animals also like the ibex, closely related to the Nubian wild goat or Nubian ibex, found in Sinai. I went a few years ago to the biblical zoo, which is located in Jerusalem, with the hope of seeing an Asiatic lion, with the hope of seeing the ibex, which is native to Israel, and with the hope of seeing some of the vipers that are native to Israel. And to my dismay, I don't think I saw any of the three. The lion that they had, I'm sure, was the African lion. The Asiatic lion looks a little bit more slender, maybe a little taller, smaller mane. And the Asiatic lion is very close to becoming extinct. I think there is a refuge for them in India today. But the numbers of them coming down to simply hundreds, they're very close to becoming extinct. And I was hoping to see such in the biblical zoo, but did not. And then I was hoping to see the Nubian ibex, and as far as I know, I did not see any of those. If I saw any, they were the females. I was looking for one of the big bucks with the long horns that curl back maybe 3 feet back over their shoulders. And then when I went to visit the viper house, I learned that it was closed. It was going to be closed for about an hour and a half, and when it was going to be reopened, it would be too late for me, so I had to leave without seeing some of these things. But in Jerusalem, there's a zoo called Biblical Zoo. There's a disappointment after you've seen the Philadelphia Zoo. But nevertheless, in many of the cages, they have scripture verses or scripture references posted above the cage. So where you have a cage with an eagle in it or a vulture or other birds that are mentioned in the Bible, these are mentioned above the cages in the zoo. And that part, of course, made it worthwhile and made it very fascinating. Just a few words about the birds that are found in Sinai. Again, we find that the birds that we find in Sinai are very well adapted to life in the desert. First of all, birds generally have higher temperatures than other animals. And so when the summer is extremely hot, they don't have the problem of adjusting or adapting to the extreme of the heat. Of course, the birds have feathers, which are good insulators. The birds have the ability to fly some distances in search of water, so they're not as limited as animals might be when it comes to water. And some of the animals, of course, get their water from the prey that they eat. And of course, the same is true for the birds from some of the foods and some of the prey that they might eat. Again, the birds are adapted to desert life in that their body wastes are almost dry and very concentrated. And so that not much moisture is lost in that way. Presently in Sinai, you occasionally see quail. The quail generally migrate from the southern parts of Europe and land on the shores of Sinai, usually very exhausted. Up until recently, the Bedouin who lived in the area trapped the quail in nets and kept them in cages for a month or two and tried to fatten them up and then tried to sell them on the market. The migration of the quail from Europe usually occurs in September and October, and come into or onto the shores of Sinai. It's been pointed out that the numbers of the quail are decreasing very rapidly, and efforts are being made to protect them. We hope that their numbers will return. Now, just a few words about some of the natural resources of Sinai. I must hasten on. In ancient times, the Egyptians sought for turquoise in the mountains of Sinai. The turquoise is a blue-green stone and was one of the favorite semi or precious stones known in the land of Egypt. The Egyptians used it in rings and beads and necklaces and amulets and so on. And some of the pictures I'm going to share with you in a moment are related to Egyptian mining that was done in the heart of Sinai. And as the miners were working, they, in some instances, wrote some inscriptions on the walls of the of their mines, and some of these are referred to as the proto-Sinaitic inscriptions. Over here on my left, there's a chart, and at the very top of it, there's mention of the proto-Sinaitic inscriptions and an attempt to decipher them and relate them to other ancient forms of the alphabet, and this is probably one of the earliest forms of writing that's closely related to Hebrew. Was back to about 1500 B.C. On the very bottom of the chart, next to the last line, we mention of some of the Nabataean inscriptions. And this, too, is of interest to us in our study of the alphabet and how it came down to us. And we'll say a little bit about that, if time permits. But anyway, the Egyptians sought for turquoise, and this explains how they sometimes made expeditions into Sinai in search of that stone. Copper was found in Sinai, too, in ancient times, and in Timnah, not too far from the port of Eilat, copper mining has been done up until recent years. But I understand that the copper mining has is dwindling in Sinai because there are richer sources of copper ore elsewhere. It may be, however, that the days of Lot, when Lot was seized by kings who came from Mesopotamia, and he was carried away and eventually delivered by Abraham, it may be that one of the things that the invaders were seeking was copper in the vicinity of the southern parts of the Dead Sea and further on in the Sinai. At least this is a suggestion that some have made, and it seems very plausible. Also in Sinai, there is oil. Oil, petroleum, was first found there in 1916. And since 1946, the oil fields have been developed. These oil fields are on the western side of Sinai, facing the Gulf of Suez. All right, now I think I'll take off this microphone and go to the slides and quickly. Okay. In the summer of 1974, I had the opportunity of traveling with a camping group, an 8-day camping trip down into Sinai. This truck, four-wheel drive, was our home for 8 days, and there were about 36 or 37 in our group. We had a mixed group. There were a number of Southern Baptist missionaries who conduct work in Israel. I might add that the Southern Baptists have probably the most effective work in Israel in that they were there before Israel became a nation in 1948, and so they have been able to continue on in their ministry there. But new works are difficult to begin in Sinai. We shared the camping responsibilities and cooking responsibilities, and just to illustrate the wide spectrum of people that we had in our group, on the right, the girl in the red blouse is a Jewish girl who's studying at the University of Colorado, and she went to Hebrew University for her junior year of study. The man in the white hat is from Germany, And he is a principal of some Christian day schools in the vicinity of Jerusalem. The top left, the man with the white t-shirt, is a Southern Baptist missionary who was working in Israel and took the opportunity of joining the camping group in the Sinai so that he might better relate to the modern Israelis. This is the port of Eilat, and back in 1974, the Gulf of Suez, or the Suez Canal, was still closed because of the shipping that had been sunk there. And so much oil was coming from Persia at that time and was being unloaded at Eilat and was pumped across Sinai to the port of Ashdod on the Mediterranean. And from there was shipped abroad into the Mediterranean ports. As you go down along the eastern coast of Sinai, you see beautiful coral beneath the surface of the waters. You see a blue and green color. And this little area is called Coral Island. And the ruins that you see probably belong to the days of the Crusaders. Some suggested that this might be the place of Ezi and Geber. And some, of course, might say it should be located at where Eilat is today. But anyway, this would lend itself for shipping, as was known in Bible times. Just a scenic shot along the eastern shores of Sinai. And halfway down along the eastern shores, you come to a place called Sharm el-Sheikh. It's become something of a winter resort for the modern Israelis. And also a very strategic military installation here as well. As you go down to the very tip of Sinai, you come to a section called Ras Muhammad. And here you see a number of Egyptian tanks that have been knocked out. Sometimes when you visit Sinai and the Holy Land, you see tanks that have been stripped of every available part, and some of them have just been left, like these have been left, as memorials to some of the wars. On the western shore of Sinai, there's a small port called Dor. It's close to being an abandoned city or town. It was important in years past when Muslim peoples were involved in their pilgrimage from North Africa to Mecca. They would sometimes pass through the port of Dor. And on their return home, they would have to stop at Dor, where medical doctors would examine them to make sure they were free of any serious disease. Because those who go on the pilgrimage to Mecca encounter large crowds of people, and there's much opportunity for transmission of serious diseases. We go up about a third of the way up the western side of Sinai, and then we cut inland. And as you travel, say, from the tip of Sinai, the very tip of Sinai is very mountainous, rugged mountains like these which you see here. As you move farther up into Sinai, you get into a broad, rather flat plain, the area called the T-I-H. This is a very beautiful scenic shot taken in the interior of Sinai. And off in the distance, you see a small oasis, maybe 3-4 miles away. This, the next few pictures reflect the scenery as you see it today in the area called the Wilderness of Paran. Here you see the remains of a building that's located on a mountaintop, and you see the rugged ridges which surround it. You find that in the early days of the church, especially in the days of the Byzantine people, Byzantine Christians, many of them felt it was good and super spiritual to go into the remote areas of Sinai and other parts of the world to live in caves or to build monasteries on the very tops of some of the mountains. Here's the remains of such a building. This kind of thing was especially popular between 300 and 600 A.D. and reflects the attitude that's reflected in the New Testament, where you read how that Satan took Jesus or tempted Jesus when he was in the wilderness. We read about the Gadarene demoniac and others. And some have gotten out of this the idea that the forces of evil were especially powerful in the wilderness. And so some of the devout men of the ancient church went out into the wilderness to pray and to fight Satan head on, so to speak. Some shots of the wilderness of Paran. You have an area here, or wadi, that might be 6-7 miles long, where there's abundance of green growth. The most luxurious of all the wadis that we saw in Sinai. Again, in the wilderness of Paran, you see the remains of the ancient structure at the very top of the mountain. Here you see some of the acacia trees, and as you go into the higher elevations, you don't see the acacia trees anymore. Here's an acacia tree, and hanging in the acacia tree is a Bedouin tent. I understand that the Bedouin have the custom of hanging their tents, folding their tents, and hanging them in a tree. The Bedouin have a law that whatever is hanging in a tree is private property. Whatever is scattered on the ground is up for grabs. And so the Bedouin, they fold up a tent that might be worth $1,000, hang it in the tree, and of course this protects it also from the ground and ground creatures. And they may wander a few hundred miles away in search of pasture for the flock, and then months later return to this site once more. These are the thorns that are found on branches, twigs of the acacia tree. This is a picture of the tamarisk tree found in Sinai, another one of the common desert trees. And here we see a few date palms in the foreground and some, of course, in the distance. We stopped here for a lunch near the end of our first day of travel from Jerusalem down into Sinai. And here again, some of the date palms. Here's some examples, some of the plants that you might see growing in the very dry ground in Sinai. And I must say, I don't know the names of all of them. Remember correctly, this plant, I believe, is used, though, in pickling such things and as a spice or seasoning. Here's a little plant. It's like tiny forms of wild cotton. Little plants that look like wild begonias. These are some of the plants especially that I saw as we climbed Sinai, climbed up, I should say, Jebel Musa, the mountain of Moses. And these are mangrove bushes, which have the ability of also growing in salty water. And here you see the typical black goats. And here the dog, as referring to earlier, I think she wanted to be friendly, but I was afraid to come much closer. The lizard, and of course the lizards are cold-blooded creatures, and so they feed upon vegetation in the early morning and in the evening, and go deep into the ground, maybe 5-6 feet beneath the surface during the day. You see the locust. Of course, reminded of what the Bible says about the locust and locust plagues. The study of the locust is a very fascinating one. A few years ago, National Geographic published an article based upon a book written by a man who gave his lifetime to the study of the locust. I'm glad that my interests are a little bit wider than that, although I appreciate individuals who have that kind of discipline. Because the study of the locust is very fascinating in that locusts may look like the innocent grasshopper, and then at certain stages of their development, and it seems like part of this that comes on because of their contact with each other, their color changes, and their temperament changes, and they become very voracious, and they move in great hordes across the land, devouring everything in their path. And that's a long story, I must not get into that. Here you see the hedgehog. It seems like a cross between the groundhog and the porcupine. This is a nocturnal animal, feeds upon green vegetation. Now I want to look at the problem of water. Water, of course, is very strategic in all parts of the Holy Land, and especially in Sinai. Here you see a well located near a Bedouin encampment. In the foreground, you see the trough into which the water can be poured from the pail for the watering of the animals. Here you see a Bedouin encampment, Bedouin tent. The tents are made of goat's hair, and of course in summertime, the tents usually are on a knoll where this will help the people to pick up the cool desert breezes, In the wintertime, the tents are moved to the shelter of the cliffs and the mountains, and of course the tent flaps are kept down. So the goat hair, makes a very good tent covering. I had difficulty understanding this until recently when I read that goat's hair, when it becomes wet from rain or snow, the fibers swell and thus makes close to an airtight protection. We came to a site in Sinai. Evidently our guide had visited here before, and she knew enough Arabic to persuade this young Bedouin man to make us a little bit of Bedouin bread and some Bedouin coffee, enough for each one of us to get a little taste. As we sat under the shade of the acacia tree and waited for him to prepare these things for us, I was reminded of Genesis 18, where we read how Abraham entertained the angels that came to his home, his camp. Here you see the Bedouin children. Tourist trade has increased in Sinai, and it seems like it was intensive in anticipation of the fact that Sinai would be turned over to the Egyptians. In fact, that was one reason why I was anxious to get down to Sinai when I did. And so many of the tour groups that came to Israel included in their tour a visit to Sinai. And here you see a Bedouin girl, considered to be of marriageable age, and so her face is veiled. The mouth to the Bedouin is considered that part of the female anatomy that is most exciting to the male, and so they cover their mouth. For the ancient Chinese, it was a dainty little female foot. If there are other societies, it might be some other part of the anatomy. But anyway, for the Bedouin is the mouth, and that's why they veil the mouth. And I might add, I've heard said that the Bedouin women smoke heavily, and they mastered the art of smoking while still wearing their veils without burning down their tents. Again, some of the things I'm showing here are people related. Here you see a cemetery. Off to the left you see some of the headstones, and to the right you see a sheikh's tomb. Sometimes a sheikh, known for his maybe leadership and maybe his wisdom and so on, eventually these people who are very simple in their religious beliefs, sometimes animistic, might actually worship some of their leaders who have died. So the sheikh's tomb is a little more impressive than that of the average man. And this is what it looks like inside. Next time I get back, I'm going to get up enough courage to look under the keffiyeh to see what might be there. I did not peek the first time I was there. But you see colored woven material there. You might see such things as a chewing gum wrapper or paper clip, something that the Bedouin might not even know what it is, and so they consider it very fascinating, or it becomes a superstition to them. And they take it in and place it here inside the sheikh's tomb. A few words about the inscriptions. In Sinai, of course, we mentioned the proto-Sinaitic inscriptions. I don't have pictures of that, but these were cut on the caves or the mines on the top of Sirabit al-Kadhim. We'll say that something about that in a moment if I can get to it. But here you see some inscriptions called the Nabataean inscriptions. But along with these Nabataean inscriptions, there are inscriptions that are in Greek, some that are in Armenian, and I might add that until recently, most of these inscriptions were not studied very carefully, because preliminary study of these disclosed the fact that they didn't say very much, really. Nothing more than maybe Kilroy was here. You see also attempt at art. You see the camels and people trying to ride and drive the camel. You see a Byzantine-type cross and so on. Here, inscriptions that look maybe a little bit more like the Nabataean inscription. And Israeli archaeologists and Israeli linguists have been studying these recently. Again, sort of a crash program before they return over Sinai to the Egyptians, which they did a year or two ago. Here you see a menorah in the cut in the stone of Sinai. Here you see a very fascinating building in Sinai. There are about 40 such structures in Sinai. These are about 6 to 8 feet high, and maybe 10, 15 feet in diameter. And there's a small doorway that allows you to enter inside. There are all kinds of suggestions as to what these structures were. They are called Nawamis, N-A-W-A-M-I-S. All kinds of suggestions, but I think probably the closest or best suggestion is that they were used for burial places or semi-burial places for the people of the area. You know, in ancient times, there was a custom of burying the dead in the ground among many people, and then after the flesh had decayed, the bones were taken up and placed in boxes called ossuaries, and it's believed that this may be the way or the real purpose for this structure, these structures called the Nawamis. Another fascinating thing about these structures is that these go back, it's been estimated, I think, to about 2500 BC, and they have roofs made of interlocking stones. And these are the oldest buildings, any place in the world that I know of, where the roofs have been maintained and stayed intact over so many centuries. We also had opportunity to visit some of the tells of Sinai, and some of the crossroads in Sinai. We found evidence of mounds or tells where there had been occupation in ancient times. And we stopped at some of these and searched the tells with the hope of finding some pottery. We did find a few flint knives and a few flint tools. And then our guide urged us to put them down again, so that others might also have the excitement of finding such implements. There's a problem that there's some people who will carry away the things from the natural parks and let's destroy them. Here I think we're at the beginning of our trek to take us up to the top of some of these mountains, where is the site of an ancient Egyptian temple, the largest Egyptian temple outside of the land of Egypt. And it's called Serabit El Kadam. We'll see it spelled out for us in a few moments. This is the trek upward. I sometimes tell groups that I spent the summer of 1973 painting my neighbor's house to earn the money that would help me take this trip. And then I became involved in climbing some of these cliffs, and the irony of the whole thing is I don't like heights. Here we're looking down upon the as you look up, it doesn't look that steep, but as you look down, you see the steep slopes that we had just climbed. We're at the site called Serabit El Kadam, and you see the temple probably has beginnings at the left of the diagram that you see. You know, it's somewhat J-shaped, a J on a 90-degree lying on its side. And then to the extreme right, you notice that it curved. And it had to curve because there was the mountain there prevented the temple from being built in a straight line. And so that part of the temple is curved off. Evidently, the Egyptian miners, as they came here, they were especially worshiping a goddess called Hathor. And they prayed to her with a hope that she would help them find the valuable turquoise. And so to honor her, they at times became involved in the building or adding a portion to the temple called Serabit El Kadam. And of course, this is not too far from the places where the mining was done, and also within some of those mines, you have the famous proto-Sinaitic inscriptions. In recent study here, some additional information has been uncovered. Not a whole lot, but additional information adding to what already has been learned about the proto-Sinaitic inscription. Here you see the image of the goddess Hathor. Usually was depicted with long curls coming down upon her shoulders. Sometimes she's depicted by the cow. This is the goddess Hathor, H-A-T-H-O-R. Here you see a small image of a baboon. This baboon was removed from this site by Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan was one of the important politicians of Israel. He died not too long ago, and he had a very valuable private collection. I think it was sold. I think he sold it for over $1 million, if I remember correctly. And he removed this to put it into his private collection. When the Israelis realized what he had done, they complained so much they didn't put it back. And rightfully so. Rightfully so. And here's some of the stela that stand at Serabit El Kadam. Many of these are inscribed with pictures and with hieroglyphs. Many of these are suffering from the sands and the winds, the sandstorms that blow across this area, because they have a very erosive action, like sandpaper. And so some of these are deteriorating badly. Here you see at the base of this stela a picture of a man leading his donkey, and may depict possibly the Egyptian miner coming into the area with his equipment. Now we move to another building. We talked about the Serbi El Kadam, we talked about the Nawamis, and now just a few words about the St. Catherine's Monastery. St. Catherine's Monastery goes back to the 6th century, and it's a Greek Catholic monastery. There were times that there were as many as 600 monks who resided here. Today, the number is down to about 6 or 7. You notice it's a fortress. Notice how it dwarfs, the walls of the monastery dwarf the bust that stands next to the wall. And of course, there were times in the Middle Ages when barbaric peoples would have wiped out the monastic group here if it were not for those great walls. This is a picture of the monastery gardens, and with various trees and vineyards and so on that the monks have here. This is a picture from within the monastery. In a small building in the monastery gardens, the building called the Charnel House, where the bones of the monks are kept in the basement. Here you see a monk called Saint Stephanus. You actually see the skeleton clothed in the garments of the monk, and this enclosed in a glass case or closet. And in the Charnel House, in the basement of this structure, now you see Saint Stephanus. You also see the heads of the monks. And another place, you see the limbs of the monks stacked up like kindling wood. Again, the same burial place is used repeatedly in Sinai or in St. Catherine. And so after a monk dies, after the flesh has decayed from his bones, the bones are taken up and they're placed in the charnel house in the gardens of St. Catherine's Monastery. St. Catherine's Monastery is very important to us for two reasons. First of all, for the icons that are found at Sinai, because the icons at Sinai survived the iconoclastic controversy which prevailed in Europe in 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries. In fact, warfare actually broke out in Europe over the use of the icons. Some said the icons and the use of the icons was idolatrous, and others said no, they weren't. And the controversy was very bitter. Sinai was remote, and of course was not involved in the conflict. And so there are about 2,000 icons, I understand, that are found in St. Catherine's Monastery. And so the icons that are found at St. Catherine's help to preserve what otherwise might be a gap in the history of religious art. And here's probably the best of the icons. This is a picture of St. Peter. We had the opportunity of climbing to the top of Jebel Musa, Mount Sinai. And we rose up about 2:30 in the morning. We're ready to start our trek about 3 o'clock, and we got to the base of Sinai about 5 o'clock in the morning, and then we began our trek. And we had opportunity to take a few pictures as the sun started to rise. Our time is rapidly fleeting, so I have just a few more and we'll be done. Just a few shots as the sun rose on Sinai. This is a picture we took at the very top of Sinai, where we took time to read the Ten Commandments. Again, the monks have worked on some of the paths going up and going down from Jebel Musa, making it fairly easy to climb. We rose up early, however, so that we might beat the heat of the hot sun. And here are just a few pictures related especially to natural resources and the topography. These are the mountains of Timnah, taken from the moving truck. And, of course, back in those mountains is where Solomon had his copper mines. Here you see we had opportunity for a number of treks back into some of the wadis, little nature hikes back into areas like this. Again, if you're at the right place, the right time, you can get some very unusual and colorful shots. Again, I might add that if you are interested in geology, I hope that someday you visit Sinai, because it has many things I'm sure that would be of interest to the geologists. Again, even close up. Again, I've not had the proper lenses to get all this in one shot. As I tried to back up, I faced the predicament of falling off a cliff. I'm coming to an area where there's some black stone. When you take the stone, you knock it, one stone against another, it has a very metallic sound. All kinds of suggestions as to how this came, how this was formed. Some suggested that maybe there was a lake here at one time, and the plants in the lake attracted certain minerals to them, and eventually the plants died, and thus you have these columns that look like large candles just strewn over the area. It's referred to by modern Israelis as Tuvia's Forest, named after a man named Tuvia, a geologist. And notice here, you notice that they are hollow, start looking down the gun barrel. And so the suggestion that maybe plants attracted these minerals, and eventually the plants died and the columns were left. Here we see our guide, Ora Lipschutz. She is a student at Hebrew University and working on a PhD there. Back in 1974, she had led by that time some 75 different tours into Sinai. She even served as a guide for the Israeli army. The man on the right with a straw hat is an Israeli army officer, and he joined us for part of the tour. The boy in the center with the blue hat is the park guard, an Arab boy who lives nearby, and when people come to visit this area, he comes out to prevent people from picking up some of the things that are here in this nature park. Again, a few general shots. I think that's the last one we have, one like the one we start with, or near the beginning of our slide showing. And with that, we have to stop. Prayer time is up, but I'm going to answer, or try to answer, a few questions, if there are questions.
All right. Questions.
We covered a lot of ground in the hour that we had together. I hope I didn't go too fast. Of course, the area of geology is one that's fascinating to me, but I lack the training in that particular area, that particular discipline. But I would like to go to Sinai with someone who is a Christian geologist and see how he would evaluate some things that he would see there. Yes. Yes, they do. In fact, I meant to say that we mentioned, first of all, that Sinai, St. Catherine's, is important to us for two reasons. I didn't mention the second one. The first reason, of course, was the icons, but secondly, Codex Sinaiticus, one of the most valuable manuscripts of the Bible that we have, which is now on display in the British Museum, was found in the libraries of St. Catherine's. And the beautiful story that goes with that, I might add. I might add also that in the last 3 or 4 years, hundreds and thousands of additional manuscripts have been discovered. And because the monks at St. Catherine's had a bad experience with the Codex Sinaiticus, they are rather slow and reluctant to publish information pertaining to these new manuscripts. A man by the name of Charlesworth, who is an expert in the study of ancient inscriptions, has visited there a number of times, and he's also published some of his findings, especially in the magazine called Biblical Archaeologist, in the issues of 1978, 79, and 1980 especially. In fact, I looked at them in anticipation of my coming up here. I don't know when we'll hear more about them, but there is this problem. Because earlier, back in the 1850s and around the 1850s, Tischendorf, a German scholar, visited Sinai and discovered valuable manuscripts of the Bible there, and got permission to take the Codex Sinaiticus from the library there And so there are two different points of view. Tischendorf says that he had permission to take it, and he gave it to the Tsar of Russia. While the monks claim that this was never done. And so there's this bitter spirit as a result of this. And this is why some of the present manuscripts are slow in being revealed and coming to light. But in some repair work done at the monastery recently, boxes of ancient manuscripts have been discovered. The monastery is located near Jebel Katerina and Jebel Musa in Sinai, so that as you come down from Mount Sinai, the site or the mountain associated with the giving of the tables of the law, as you come down from the mount, as you get close to halfway down, you eventually can see the St. Catherine's Monastery in the valley below. In fact, the original intention was to build St. Catherine's Monastery on the top of one of the mountains in that area. And of course, that made it very difficult because there's no water available on the top of the mountains. And when the monastery would be besieged by enemies, the people within would perish. So it's good that it was built in the valley below. But I might add that the one who supervised the building, at least the beginnings of St. Catherine's Monastery, was beheaded by the ruling monarch because he, instead of building it on the top of the mountains in the area, he built it in the valley below and near the site associated with the burning bush. Again, of course, there's a lot of superstition that goes with some of these things, such things as the burning bush. In fact, within the walls of St. Catherine's, you see a vine growing, and by it, in English, you see a sign that says, the burning bush. And so it reminded, of course, of Greek Catholics and Roman Catholics and others, very superstitious sometimes in regards to things like this. Also in reference to St. Catherine's, there's a legend about St. Catherine, who was a Christian young woman who was persecuted for her faith in Egypt and was eventually beheaded. And tradition says that her body was carried to some of the remote mountains of Sinai. Eventually, some of the monks at St. Catherine's found her body and brought it down to the monastery at St. Catherine's. And so there's the skull of St. Catherine and I think it's the hand of St. Catherine, which is sometimes brought out and shown to tourists and to visitors at St. Catherine's monastery. So there are a lot of traditions that goes with it. I'm not sure. In the last 2 years or so, the portion where St. Catherine's is located has been turned over now to Egyptian control. I'm not sure how difficult it is to visit there. We, of course, went down by bus and eventually went into the heart of Sinai and visited St. Catherine's. Up until recently, the usual way was to fly from somewhere near Jerusalem, some commercial lines, and fly within maybe 30 or 40 miles of St. Catherine's, and then from there take a bus or a truck or car into St. Catherine's. That's the fastest way. We took the more rugged way, but again, I'm sure the better way. So, as to how accessible it is now, I don't know. I don't know. Yes. I mentioned the biblical archaeologist, which has some articles on the inscriptions especially, and also on the efforts to get a hold of or to decipher some of the newly found inscriptions at St. Catherine's. Also, from time to time, magazines like National Geographic carry some very fine articles. In preparation for my talk this evening, I looked at a copy of 1948, another copy from 1964. There are probably other copies, but I looked at those especially. There is a book that was published back around 1962 by a man with a rather foreign-sounding name, something like Skrobucha, S-K-R-O-B-U-C-H-A. That may not be the exact spelling, but that's pretty close. In fact, I asked one of the students from Biblical to look for books on Sinai in the Biblical Library, and they came back with that book, and I happen to have it out of the PCB library, and I had read it already. A recent book that probably would be very good, in fact, two recent books, one by Ora Lipschutz, the lady that was the leader of the tour in the Sinai that I enjoyed. Ora Lipschutz wrote a book simply called Sinai, one volume of possibly a multiple volume work that she is hoping to do. And then more recently, there's a work by simply called Sinai by Benno Rothenberg, Rothenberg. In fact, I tried very hard to get a hold of that book before I came up here, but I could not do it. And but I would gather it's a very good book. It's a very expensive book. I think it costs about $45. And but I'm hoping to get it soon. But I couldn't get it in time for my visit here. But I think that probably would have a lot of up-to-date information. There are other books on Sinai, but I can't recall the names of them. There's another one that I was trying to get a hold of. I decided not to try or pursue it any further when I realized that it was primarily about the St. Catherine's. Many of the books that deal with the Sinai zero in on St. Catherine's. Maybe we're getting dry. Dry as Sinai.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fox.